Hello, hysterical community. It's Amanda here. I'm always so blown away by our live talk shows and the audiences that show up. You come prepared with questions, very, very specific questions, and a sense of community where we're participating in learning alongside each other and we're participating in each other's growth, sometimes healing, sometimes expanding as we delve into this topic of menopause. The number one reason we created Hysterical is to create a whisper culture around things that we haven't talked about before. Whisper culture being this context of sharing information, passing it down from generation to generation, but also passing it among each other in our current generation. So I'm really excited to bring you this conversation today with Dr. Mandy and Dr. Hannah Leonhardt and Short, respectively. They wrote a book around premature ovarian insufficiency in early menopause. And one thing is for sure, it's that we aren't talking about this enough, and we're excited to learn alongside you. So without further ado, I'm going to drop you straight into the conversation.
Hello, Team Hysterical. It's Amanda. Hi. I'm so happy to be with you today and to be bringing this really important conversation. Today, we're talking about the complete guide to premature ovarian insufficiency and early menopause with Hannah Short and Mandy Leonhardt. Dr. Hannah Short is a leading GP specialist in menopause, premature ovarian insufficiency, and premenstrual disorders, and has achieved formal recognition as a menopause specialist accredited by the British Menopause Society and the FSRH. She is certified by the International School of Gynecological Endocrinology and is dedicated to advancing hormonal health, to which we say, huzzah! I'm so here for that. And Dr. Mandy Leonhardt is the founder and director of Hormone Equilibrium, is a GMC-registered GP deeply committed to women's health, nutrition, and healthy aging, certified in menopause care, again, by the British Menopause Society, sort of picturing who all these people are in the British Menopause Society. It seems very posh sitting here in North America. We don't have a society for menopause.
You do. You have the North American Menopause Society.
But whenever we say society, it doesn't seem like society. It seems like this bastardized American version of society. But why we're talking to you two today is because you co-authored this amazing book called The Complete Guide to Premature Ovarian Insufficiency and Early Menopause, POI. This is something we haven't talked about for Hysterical at all. And I'm so thrilled we're all thrilled to be joined by you. So thank you for joining us. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for inviting us on.
Yeah, it's terrific. You know, I just asked, and this is a random starter, but I said, what was your meet cute? How did the two of you meet to co-author a book? And you met on Twitter. Tell everybody about that, because that's, well, Twitter now X. It's it's a good meet cute story.
We don't even really remember the details, Mandy, do we? But I mean, we were both talking, I think, about menopause quite a few years ago before it was the hot topic that it seems to be becoming now, which is great that awareness has improved. But we were in different parts of the UK, and we were trying to work out, you know, what would be the best place to kind of meet, because it was probably about 3 or 4 hour drive between us. And Mandy set up a menopause cafe with one of her colleagues, which she'll tell you a bit more about. And I went down, she kind of invited me, and that's when we first met face to face. And then we've kind of stayed in contact since. And we don't get to see each other face to face that often, just because life is busy in geography and things like that. But we do chat, and we wrote the book together. So we did a lot of that actually over the kind of lockdown years, to be honest.
Remotely, that was interesting with a short document. So we had a Google document, and sometimes Hannah wrote, and I could see her little cursor moving along, and that put lots of pressure on me to also keep on in a different part of the book.
Tracking your connection with people through a shared document. I totally relate to that statement. So just for our listeners who are tracking, Mandy has the beautiful and soft German accent, and Hannah has the more pronounced British accent. So that's where our friends are for all those that are listening. Okay, so POI, I mean, it's something not a lot of people know about. I think 1% of people, of women or people who are born with ovaries are diagnosed with POI. What is it, and how did you come to this subspecialty? Because it's obviously some of these more acute sort of things that happen to us, it takes someone who's passionate about it to bring it to the light. And so we feel lucky that you two are passionate about it. But how did that come to be?
Well, I mean, I don't know, I'll start in terms, I mean, obviously it's always been, it's been part of the kind of menopause space when you're working as a doctor, but it doesn't get anywhere near as much attention, I think, because it's assumed that it affects so few women. In actual fact, we think the 1% number that we kind of give out is quite a large underestimate. And now estimates recommend it's between 3 to 4%, with some studies saying it might be closer to 7%. But lots of things depend on how you're measuring or defining POI, whether you're including women and people who've had like a medical and surgical menopause and things like that. My personal interest came from a personal experience. I've always had gynecological health issues, and I ended up having a hysterectomy and ovarian removal at 35. And so I went into an early, premature surgical menopause, which with the new kind of way we're supposed to be naming things is surgical POI, although we can come on to the differences, I guess, between what POI and menopause are, because they're not entirely the same thing. But essentially, I was still thrown into this kind of state of estrogen, you know, deficiency at a very young age. Well, a relatively young age, because there are people far younger than me who were affected by that. And I figured that if I was still struggling as a medical doctor to get the information and support, I didn't really know how other people were managing. And so that's kind of what fueled me in this space. And it fitted with the training that I'd done. I'd done quite a lot of work in gynecology. I had an interest in psychology and psychiatry, and I trained in general practice. And we see everything there, of course. So
how do you define POI? Like, and how do we hold the definition of that versus early menopause? Because I think early menopause is something that people more widely understand, because it's obviously that connection to what we understand for menopause. And so there's probably some layers here, you know, what is POI? How is it related to menopause? And then also, like, what is ovarian insufficiency in correlation to how we also hold menopause? That might be sort of a redundant naming. I know that was a lot there, but let's just start with what is POI.
So just to recap what the natural age of menopause is. So this is an evolutionary genetic thing that happens to all women or females who are lucky enough to live long enough. In the UK, the average age is 51 when periods on average stop. And that is that's called natural menopause. It doesn't mean that women don't have symptoms at that time or beforehand as well, but we accept this as a natural thing. Now, estrogen, our ovaries, just to go back, why our ovaries are so important, and when they don't work, why that has such an impact. They make estrogen, testosterone, and progesterone, but the most important hormone is estrogen. And we start making that during our puberty, and then up till that age, up until that time when our periods stop and our ovaries stop working. Now, if you are between 40 and 45 and you have very few periods, so you have only 3 periods a year and you skip them for more than 4 months at the time, you might, or your periods stop altogether, and you have then the diagnosis made that you're on early menopause, that would be classed as early menopause. So between 40 and 45 years of age, you're 5 years earlier, basically, as the normal age, what is considered as normal. But because it is 5 years early, it has health implications. So it is not a minor detail. It is a medical condition that ought to be treated. So ideally, we would like these women to go on HRT if they have no contraindications. So that's early menopause, age 40 to 45, either no periods at all for more than sort of 4 months, in which case they should see a doctor, or periods have stopped for another reason. In women under 40, we can go back really to those who go through puberty. So we now actually, because puberty happens younger and younger, we can now say that girls from age 11 onwards who have poor or no ovarian function or dysfunctional or non-functional ovaries, that would be then classed as POI. And we call this premature ovarian insufficiency and not menopause, because it isn't a definitive state. In some girls from a very young age, ovaries never worked. They've never been healthy enough to work or do anything. And then there is another group where they had normal puberty where ovaries did do their job and then they stop working at a certain time. That can be at any age between, let's say, after puberty, between age 18 to age 40. So this is because it is so variable, and because sometimes ovaries do have a small activity, sometimes make a little bit of estrogen, not enough compared to a healthy woman at that age. It isn't a definitive state, but it obviously is very much affecting the health and the well-being of the people who are affected. So menopause is obviously a complete loss of fertility, and there is a very, very little chance of conceiving. And the same applies to POI, but we still advise these women to if they do not want to get pregnant, to use contraception, for example. So there's another difference, because there is about a 5% risk of, or 5% chance, you can call it chance, of getting pregnant, but it depends what your decision is. So we do need to advise them about contraception, for example. And that's really the difference. Whereas a woman who's 51, who's had no period for 1 year, she no longer needs contraception. She can go off and do things. Whereas women with POI need to also consider that. So basically, the bottom line is, from age 11 till age 40, if ovaries aren't doing their job properly, not making enough estrogen, either have never worked or have slowed down along the way, we call that POI. Between the ages of 40 and 45, we call that we call that early menopause. And of course, inevitably, POI leads on to early menopause often.
Is a way to hold it, and that was a very beautiful explanation. It's sort of like if you have POI, your car never really like got on the on-ramp to get on the highway, right? And so then, you know, menopause is the off-ramp, and maybe and some people, you know, get off the highway sooner than others. But POI, you never really got on the highway, or you're on some of those side roads looking at the highway trying to get on.
Sorry, Hannah, but I just mentioned this. I'll let Hannah talk about. But some people will have entirely normal ovarian function up to age 35.
Okay.
When then they realize that they skip their periods. What's happening? They feel unwell. They have hot flushes and they don't sleep anymore. So it can happen at any age. There is no distinct lead up, as you described with the highway thing. This is so individual, so different from in between different. It can happen at any age, pretty much. But unfortunately, some girls are born with ovaries that they never work. They never go through a normal puberty without help. They need hormones. You experience a normal puberty. But then there are also girls who have entirely normally functioning ovaries up till a certain age, even up till their early 30s. And they only realize when they try and get pregnant that there's something not right. Mm-hmm. So it isn't always, they might have been on the pill and they may have regular periods, and then they come off the pill, they try to get pregnant, and they were told, well, actually, you don't have follicles. Sorry, Hannah.
No, I was just saying, I think that the thing is, there are so many different things that can lead to POI or an early menopause that there is not a single trajectory. There's so many things that can contribute. Mm-hmm. And I think this is when it becomes quite confusing. And in our book, we did spend quite a bit of time exploring the differences, but also to say the things that unite people who are affected with POI or early menopause are essentially premature loss of ovarian function and hormones, and reduced fertility or infertility. And so they can affect people of, you know, all ages. But down to the individuals, it depends, you know, different things are going to affect some people more than others. But it's a very complex landscape, really, isn't it?
It sounds incredibly complex. And I can't imagine being someone who's on the pill and not getting your period and then coming off the pill to get pregnant and realizing you have no follicles. And so what we're learning, obviously, in this work is your periods are not the only indicator of, healthy ovarian function, right? Like, there are all these different symptoms, 34 different correlated symptoms to perimenopause and menopause. And what I'm wondering is there something for us to be aware of for ourselves and our daughters and things like that, that might not be correlated to periods? You know, are there ways to start to recognize POI or to start to understand if that might be happening outside of your getting your periods?
I mean, I think it's difficult because, as you know, with kind of menopause, a more natural kind of older age, perimenopausal symptoms can impact every bodily symptom. But a lot of these will overlap with other things, which is sometimes why perimenopause isn't picked up when it should be in women even of natural menopausal age or perimenopausal age. And the same can be said for younger girls and women as well. You know, things like fatigue or, you know, things like that. Fatigue can be anything. It can be a mental, you know, secondary to a mental health condition. It could be a chronic autoimmune condition, which could be contributing to POI. And so it's very hard to say there's things. I mean, the main things you look for is really a change in menstrual cycle. And if there are any symptoms that are associated or could be connected to low levels of estrogen. But often that's missed because people at 15 or, you know, women at 25 don't expect to be going through an early menopause or developing POI. So it's more kind of looking at the overall picture and seeing if somebody's health has changed, they're having more and more irregular periods, their periods have stopped, they haven't had a bleed for 4 months. They would be the things to kind of go to the doctor about and say, I'm concerned, and make sure that people aren't fobbed off and told, well, are you stressed? Because I think a lot of girls and women, particularly in the younger age, you know, exam study, is their relationship stress, you know, all the stresses of young adulthood. And actually later on, people are put down to that, well, actually you're busier in work. And maybe if some women have had children at a younger age, say in their 20s, maybe it's because they're a mum and they're busy and that's why their periods have, you know, stopped. They're just very stressed with life. The only things you can really do is think about history. You know, family history can be connected, but it depends on the kind of POI you're talking about. So if there's a history where, say, your mother or grandmother has gone through an early menopausal POI, that might increase somebody's risk. And as looking at associated conditions, so certain genetic conditions or autoimmune conditions and their history. But it's such a vast thing. There are so many things that can lead to POI. It's more a diagnosis of exclusion, really, in younger women and girls. So if people are worried about their health or, you know, parents worried about their daughter, going to the doctor explaining that, you would rule out other things like anemia, things like polycystic ovarian syndrome and everything else first.
Yeah, but periods, I think, are a vital sign of health. Mm-hmm. So if you're a young girl and you're just starting out with puberty, you may not have a robust cycle that takes a few years for the body to learn the communication between the ovaries and the brain, to get that exactly right, to get an ovulatory cycle, to release an egg each month requires a lot of fine tuning. But then once we've started our period, we should not really, once we should, we may have longer gaps in between to start with, but once we have a robust cycle in our late teens, we should go on having a cycle. Some women or girls may go on the contraceptive pill, in which case we now give them in a way that we do not have these withdrawal bleeds regularly. So that could mask potentially symptoms. But let's say you've taken the pill for many years and you always felt well on it and you've never had a problem. And then suddenly, or not suddenly, but over time, symptoms creep in. And as Hannah already said, tiredness. So a young woman, you know, this is like, I think my 20s, I had, you know, the world was my oyster. I certainly, if I didn't have a late night, I had lots of energy. I had a good amount of energy. I got up and I could do the things I wanted to do. I had no muscle aches or pains. So that's another symptom. Fatigue, muscle ache, hair thinning, but also sort of, some do get hot flushes and night sweats, but also brain symptoms. So brain fog. These are hard to pin down. You know, we can always say, oh, you're just tired, but brain fog, struggle to concentrate. But again, these are very vague symptoms, right? No, they could be associated with other things. But I do think that the periods are a very vital sign of health. And if things change to establish robust cycles that you used to have, and you don't longer have a regular cycle, particularly if you skip periods or anyone skips periods for 4 months or longer, that needs to be investigated. I think that's a really important message, because it doesn't have to be POI. It could be stress-related. As Hannah said, there's something else called functional hypothalamic amenorrhea. You know, if you overexercise, you are stressed at uni, of course it can interfere with your cycle. You could be pregnant even. You know, there are lots of reasons, autoimmune conditions, there could be a PCOS. But periods are, in a healthy woman, an essential vital sign. And And we have to take them seriously if they stop or if something happens to them. And then you have to take it from there. But unfortunately, it does take, we don't really know how long it takes, Hannah. I don't know what we haven't got a clear idea how long it sometimes takes for girls or women to be diagnosed, because they're often dismissed and it's been put down to stress, and they do not get the simple blood test that are often needed, or can be done to exclude POI. It's not rocket science. It's not a difficult thing to do to get an idea of what it could be. You can quite easily exclude it quite quickly, within a few weeks, really. But if you...
The thing. I mean, I think part of this platform is, you know, how can we arm ourselves with it? I'm no part of this platform. How can we arm ourselves with as much information as possible so that we can ask the right questions of our doctors and do the investigating that they might not be equipped to do? I remember in my early 30s, there was probably a 3-month period where I didn't get my period. And I realized it one day. And you know, it was because I was in a very acute stress position with my job. I was about to be fired. I was really messing up all over the place. And I'd had sex with a guy on Halloween, and I was but many months ago, oh my God, was this the person? You know what I mean? I remember being at the copy machine at my office with this dear friend that I work with, and I was probably pregnant, I'm gonna get fired, you know, all of it compounded. She's I'll take your baby. You know, I mean, I just remember this acute moment in time. And that was the only possible solution for me, you know, I'm stressed or this, right? I never would have thought, and it's a very personal story, but I think we can all relate, right? Mm-hmm. The thing that I'm sort of also oh, what did we do wrong here? At some point along the way, I don't know about in England, but here we don't make it, we don't create a lot of value around bleeding and that as a sign of health. We have all these period products to mask our bleeding. We don't talk about it. We don't even use the word bleeding. We don't associate to vitality. There's all this energy around pills and contraceptions that stop bleeding, you know? So I also feel we're maybe doing a disservice as a culture around that and that connection to our vitality and our womanhood. And I wonder if you guys have seen that get in the way, or do you see a different future if we're, you know, starting to create a culture around this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same here. I think things are changing. I think especially with social media and the way it is now, and people are speaking out and women are sharing their stories and concerns. And but I think, yeah, historically that's been the case. And I think it's, you know, we're talking about before, say, women in the 30s who maybe stops the contraceptive pill to try to conceive and then finds that she can't, and maybe undergoes some fertility investigations and finds that she's in POI. It's just the irony of trying to spend your whole entire younger adult life trying not to conceive. And everything, we just think, well, you don't want to get pregnant, you don't want to bleed and everything else. It's just, I think that the focus is in that. I mean, obviously contraception is incredibly important and we need access to it. And a lot of people, I mean, I count myself in this, my periods were absolutely horrendous, which is why I ended up with a hysterectomy in my 30s. I felt incredibly ill when I did have periods. But I think for the general population, it's important that we do talk about them, you know, whether it's what a normal cycle is or when it's abnormal and actually you need to see someone, because you shouldn't be vomiting in pain every month or not able to get out of bed. So, I mean, I think things are getting better in the world of women's health in terms of people talking out and younger generations sharing their thoughts and stories in a way that, I don't know, people in our generation are doing better, but parents' generation, they just weren't doing that. So I think things will change, but we've already got a way to go, I think.
Yeah. I think it starts in schools. You did mention, what can we do to help any future generations to have less suffering, you know, to have more awareness. And I think it starts in schools. It starts with mums talking to their daughters about what is normal, what's not. So yes, obviously there is a spectrum of what a normal period is, or when we talk about how amazing periods as a vital signs are, of course they can be a vital sign if they're manageable, if the flow isn't so high that you can't leave the house, that you're not crippling and bending over in pain. So I think it is important that girls are taught, and boys both, right, are taught, mm-hmm, in school what is normal and where should you seek help? When does it become a problem and where should you seek help? So about the flow, the pain, the symptoms you experience and how can you manage them, and giving you the options to deal with these things. There are plenty of girls who don't have any problems at all. You know, they just take a pad and if period comes on, they use it, it's fine, or a tampon. And then other girls, they miss school because of the pain. That is completely unacceptable. They miss out on academics, you know, achievement or workplace or workplace promotions. And it shouldn't be embarrassing. You know, I've heard this horrific idea of a menstrual hut in I think it's on the Asian continent, where girls who are on their periods are seen as dirty and they have to spend a week in the mountains sitting in a hut and someone brings them some food and water once a day. It's completely unacceptable, you know. But so we have a lot to do. We obviously don't have that here, but it's still I can't remember what movie I saw recently where a girl got her period and the mum opened the door and she's like, and there was blood on her dress and they didn't know how she could go and leave that cubicle to go out into the outside, you know. It shouldn't be an issue. It's just, mm-hmm. It shouldn't be an issue. You know, if you cut your finger and you run into the street and say, look, I need a plaster, can anyone help? Everyone will say, oh, you poor thing, that does look not nice. Let's wrap something around it. You know, we're not putting blame on that. And why is that any different? Someone mentioned Jen Gunter's book. I haven't read it, but I will read it. So I think it starts in school. And then we need to have these opportunistic meetings where women, either when they see their doctor, or we as medical professionals, either the nurses or doctors or teachers or other women, where we alert girls and women to, again, as they grow older, again, what is normal and what is not normal. So it starts in school with what's a normal period, what's a normal puberty, what's it like to feel like this, contraception, so on. But also there is this other gap. There are the 25 to 40 year olds. I think they're a little bit left out because they're not ready to have children, and they might not have found a partner yet. So they need contraceptive advice, and they're often not aware that the fertility is declining and they are running into a problem, and they don't have that awareness. I think the most heartbreaking cases are those that I see in the late 20s or in their 30s, where they have waited up till then, and then it hits them like, you know, it's whereas if you are told when you're 15, it's very difficult to deal with, but they make their peace at some point. That's my experience with the women and girls I've seen. But you know, if it hits you in your late 20s, when you're just at the peak of when life should be really working out, you know.
Yeah, it's all such good information. I know, you know, we've talked a lot about HRT, hormone replacement therapy, here as a protocol for perimenopausal and menopausal women, and obviously the sort of the pendulum swing of prescribing, you know, related to the Women's Health Initiative. I wonder if there was that same resistance to HRT over the past, you know, 20 years for young people, or if it's just for this older subset of women because of that WHI study. Do you guys have any insight into that?
I mean, the problem is, I think POI and early menopause have just been overlooked anyway. So I think a lot of the time these cases weren't picked up, or women were told, you're too young, it can't be that, or there was a lot of delay in them starting HRT. I think in people who knew what they're doing, like the medical professionals, if they had an understanding, they wouldn't have had the same resistance to starting HRT because they were simply replacing hormones that would naturally be there. Because when they're talking about the risks that they were presenting after the Women's Health Initiative and things like that, that was in much older women. Whose periods had naturally stopped or were stopping. But when you're talking about somebody 20, sometimes 30 years younger, I think there's always been the awareness we need that for heart protection, bone protection, potentially brain protection as well as obviously symptoms and quality of life. But I think women of all ages have suffered as a result of that over the last two decades, and younger women are no different, to be honest. But I think that you are more likely to have been started if you did see a decent medical health professional, and there wouldn't have been such hesitancy. But it's, having said that, we still hear stories, don't we, Mandy, of women of natural menopausal age, or you know, who are told they're too young. So they might be 45 and they're told, oh, you're too young for early, you know, for perimenopause. Well, you're not. Like the NICE guidelines say, you don't need to do further investigations if you have clinically menopausal symptoms at 45 or older. And yet women at 45 or 46 are told they're too young to be perimenopausal. And women underneath that, you know, people at 38 told, oh, you can't, of course you can't be menopausal. I mean, we interviewed quite a lot of young women before we wrote our book. And there were these awful stories of girls and women going to doctors over several years, sometimes saying that they're concerned that they're irregular or very sparse periods or periods that had stopped completely were due to POI or early menopause, and when we're dismissed on numerous occasions. But sometimes it is the health professional not knowing what to do with young people at that age, because in their head you start hormone replacement in mid-40s upwards, and so there's lots of things contributing, but it was not so much the kind of the fallout from the Women's Health Initiative, but
is that didn't help. HRT, is that the main
so you have to, so let's just if you compare, so in terms of the treatment, so the ovaries are a hormone producing gland, and the hormones that they produce are essential for well-being, for bone protection, for cardiovascular protection, for brain development, for puberty development, sexual characteristic development. So they are hugely important. It's a bit like if you remove a man's testicles, it's you know, that's what it's like, basically, you know. So if your ovaries aren't working, it's a gland that's not working. You can compare that to a dysfunctional thyroid gland, or if you've got diabetes, then it is obviously the implications are different, the consequence and the symptoms are different, but it's a medical condition, and this is the importance. It is not a minor thing that we can just ignore. It is a medical condition, and these women should be monitored. They need to be reviewed regularly. The treatment needs to be improved until they feel well, and until we reach a level of treatment where we are quite sure that we are preventing all these repercussions that come with not having these hormones. And HRT, so we did a lot of research in the course of the book. We looked at what is the research saying? Should we put these younger girls, should they go maybe on the combined pill, which is a synthetic estrogen? So they come in different strength. It's usually ethinyl estradiol, which is not a natural estrogen. It's a synthetic estrogen combined with a synthetic progestin. Or should they go on HRT? What is the better option? And there wasn't an awful lot of research comparing the two like for like together in a trial. But we believe that now the research is coming to the surface, is that HRT is the gold standard. So, but we should be giving girls and women the choice. I have seen a girl that, I've seen her as a woman, but she was very young when she was diagnosed. And her endocrinologist said, do you want to be like everyone else in your age group? You're 15. Do you want to go on the pill and have a period and feel like everyone else? Or do you want to go on the old granny stuff, the HRT? What did the girl say? She said, Well, I want the pill like my friends. And he did not tell her that maybe that was inferior to the HRT. I saw her when she was 25 with borderline osteoporosis, severe symptoms, not functioning, depressed, and no sexual. So she had not developed any pubic hair. So she had completely missed her puberty, but they left her for 10 years on a low dose pill. And then she said to me, doctor, I was told my ovaries aren't working and I can't have children. Why do I need to have a period every month because of that pill? It's a nuisance and I don't understand why I have to have this bleed. I have made my peace with not having children, but this bleed that the pill makes me have reminds me that I cannot get pregnant. And I said to her, well, you don't have to have a period. You know, if you naturally don't get a period, we can change your treatment. We can put you on HRT in a continuous style. There is a risk of bleeding. So I switched her to HRT and she started to blossom because the HRT, to be clear, does contain nowadays the same hormones that our own ovaries make. So we can give we can substitute the same hormones. Both the testosterone, progesterone and estrogen, they're all the same. So It isn't always easy to find the right dose for each person without causing bleeding issues and so on. There are side effects, but it is basically a replacement, a proper replacement of what ovaries, of the hormones that ovaries are naturally not producing. So it would be the more logical treatment. However, saying that, I do not want to vilify the pill. There are circumstances when a girl or a young woman wants chooses to the pill over the HRT, but we need to tell her the potential consequences. She needs to be aware. And one of the listeners has said girls are not made aware about, they don't tell girls enough about how the pill works and that it is completely different from the way HRT works. So they need to be, in medical terms, in simple terms, they need to be given the option, but how can they make an informed choice if they're not being given the information to make this choice, you know?
Yes. We have about 20 minutes left, so I want to make sure we open it up for questions. And we have one from Allison, and then Jenny piggybacks. And then if anybody else has a question and wants to come off mute and raise their hand, we'd love to call on you. But Allison asks, can you talk about the comments relative to synthetic hormones? I've read that natural is not always better. Synthetic hormones can actually better mimic our natural hormones. And in actuality, all hormones are processed in the labs. And then Jenny sort of piggybacks on that and says, you know, when you're prescribing hormones for a perimenopausal woman, it's at a very low dose. Do you prescribe a much higher dose when you're in POI? Oh, there's Allison. Hi, welcome. Great wallpaper.
Thank you.
Can I ask your question?
So synthetic, I mean, all the medications were, you know, are produced in a lab, so they're all synthetic. I think the issue is the biochemical makeup of the estrogen. So if it's ethanol estradiol that's in the pill, then that's not identical to the kind of ovarian estradiol that our bodies would produce. But we can mimic that ovarian estrogen with what we'd call body identical estrogen. So it has the same biochemical structure. And that's what we normally prescribe, especially in the UK. I think it's slightly different in the US. But in the UK, that's would be first choice would be estradiol. I know in the US it's more common. I believe that people are often prescribed conjugated equine estrogens, which a lot of people in England wouldn't want to take, and we don't really prescribe. And I understand that's more to do with insurance, and obviously we're in different healthcare systems, and I'm not that familiar with the US healthcare system, so it's tricky from that point of view. But at least in the UK, I think. In terms of synthetic, well, I think the first thing is, yes, as I think you said, Alison, in your comment, all hormones are processed in the lab. I think it's whether or not, the hormone that you're being given and prescribed, is it biochemically identical to the estrogen that your ovaries would produce, or is it different, which will have similar properties but not exactly the same, may have some benefits. And sometimes it just comes down to the individual. Like, some people just feel better on different forms. So we have, you know, this big push in the UK to say every woman should be on transdermal estrogen. So that's estrogen that goes through the skin. So, you know, you have it as a patch, a pill, a spray that you rub in, because there's no increased risk of blood clots. And there's a small increased risk of blood clots if you're taking estrogen that's given as a tablet form. Having said that, it's a much lower risk than if people are overweight, or if they smoke, or they go on a long haul flight, or if they're pregnant, for example. So it's just putting stuff into context. And some women just feel so much better when they're taking oral preparations. I think, like Mandy was saying about not wanting to vilify the pill, I don't think we'd want to vilify different types of HRT. You know, the main thing is, if somebody is able to take HRT and they haven't got contraindications to it, it's finding something that suits them. I mean, in my own case, I can't absorb through the skin. Like, so when I've had estrogen that I was put on, I just didn't absorb it. My blood levels remained low. I felt symptomatic. Oral, I didn't get on too well with, because I have a history of migraines and I just got worse headaches. I actually have implants, which are called pellets, I think, in the US. But they're quite difficult to get hold of. I initially got them in the National Health Service, but that all fell apart during COVID, and now have to get them privately. But without them, I'm quite unwell. That's the only form that tends to suit me. But I'm lucky that I am able to get them, and not everybody else is. But it comes down to, I think, choice and weighing up the risk and the benefit for each person. And as Mandy was kind of, you know, talking about the pill and everything before, if the psychological and emotional impact of POI or premature menopause can be so significant, if somebody feels so much better taking the pill because they don't feel self-conscious and they can take it every day and they're not don't feel they have to hide it, they can leave it out on their bedside table, no one's going to question them. It's so much better they're taking that than not taking any hormones. So I think that's the key thing, really. So I don't know if that answers everything, but I think if somebody's asked about the level and how do you determine appropriate HRT levels, I mean, this is a little bit tricky because depending on the type of HRT you're taking, we can't always measure the levels accurately. So taking oral HRT, you're not going to get this, you can't accurately measure the levels of estrogen in the blood. But most women will be prescribed transdermal estrogen, or like I've got the subcutaneous estrogen, and we can measure estradiols relatively accurately. There's not a lot of good research on the levels, but we tend to go for a mid-follicular level, so the level that the estrogen would be in a woman with naturally, you know, normally functioning ovaries, in kind of the mid, you know, follicular cycle. So in Britain, we often look about over 350 picomol is often the number, but every lab range is different, and that's what I was taught. But there's no real guideline on that. It's more professional consensus from the experts, just because we think that should be enough for bone protection. But above and beyond that, really, it's about titrating the dose for symptom control, because 350 is not a massive, it's not a particularly high level for a young woman, but some women will be fine, and everybody is so individual. And I know I keep saying that, but there's no one size fits all. You could have a woman in who's 18 who might be on a lower level of HRT than a woman who's 38. But that might just be what they need. And as long as we're monitoring things like bone health, heart health, and they have a good quality of life, then that's what we really need to be caring about.
That's great. Two more questions. So to dovetail on that, Becky asked, can we talk about not absorbing through the skin for a second? Didn't know that was a thing. And so if you're on the HRT patch and your estrogen was still undetectable, does that mean you're not absorbing it?
Yeah, potentially. It doesn't mean that you won't absorb all patches. This is, again, where it gets confusing. So there's different brands and there's different types of adhesive, and it's the adhesive that carries the hormone into the skin and into the bloodstream. So I've had patients, you start on one particular brand and they just don't, there's nothing. They may as well just be putting on, a sticking plaster. There's, you know, with no hormones, you change over and they're fine. Or it may be they don't absorb through the patch, but they absorb through, you put on a gel or you put on a spray. So I think the key thing is, if one thing doesn't work, don't give up. And there will be something that works. And for those women who can't take HRT, because we're very mindful that some women can end up in early menopausal POI as a result of cancer treatment, or there may be something else, these all cases won't be common, those ones that aren't related to cancer, but some women who can't take HRT or aren't able to tolerate it, there are other things you can do to help manage symptoms and protect bone health and stuff, and lifestyle and diet and stuff all come into that, but whether or not you're taking HRT.
And would you say, because we've heard conflicting ideas, measuring your blood work to see what estrogen, or is symptoms the best way to understand where you are?
I think in this age group, in women in early menopause or POI, we have to have both. In women who are over 45, perimenopausal, have stopped their periods, want to go on HRT, we don't do blood tests. We really titrate the treatment, the dose up until they reach a level where they feel comfortable or where they feel the medicine is working, the HRT is working. And then when we achieve that, we don't tend to use blood tests, provided they're using a reasonable licensed dose so that they're not using too much. But even in those in that group, we will do blood tests if we don't, if the treatment does not achieve what we've expected it to do. But in younger women, there is another concern, which is bone protection. So we don't quite know for 100% how much estrogen on average do you have in your bloodstream for your bones not to become brittle, which is called osteoporosis. And that can happen very quickly within a few years without estrogen and lifestyle. So we do not just go with symptoms in these younger women. We start them on something, we titrate it up, we do look at how they feel. We don't want them to have side effects either. If they have terrible breast tenderness and are bleeding a lot, and we don't push them up enough for no good reason. But it is meaningful to do at least once a year a blood test to check how much estradiol they have in their system. You want to get an average reading, and you may have to do this more often until they're settled. And as Hannah has said, we think that levels above 300 picomole per liter might be bone protective, but we really don't know for sure. We think that is the level. So when you are on a patch or a gel and your level comes back as 100 and you do two tests in a couple of months in a row, then the patch is not for you, right? You need to switch to a different brand of the patch if you like the patch. Do you need to switch to a gel, to a tablet, something else? Do not persevere too long. If you've persevered for 2 to 3 months on something, you have symptoms, and the blood test confirmed that the estrogen you apply through the skin does not go into your bloodstream where we need it. So we don't want to waste too much time in these women. Sometimes it takes time to get used to a new treatment, so we mustn't rush things. And if symptoms do improve, then that is a sign that the estrogen goes into the bloodstream and gets where we want it to be. But blood testing is the little needle on the, what do you call that? That thing that's on the speedometer.
Radioactive, yeah.
The Geiger counter or whatever.
The Geiger,
So it is that little determinant where we say, look, you might not have that many symptoms, but let's do a blood test to ensure that your levels are where they should be for your heart and bones, because this is another, it's not just the symptoms, it's also the long-term health consequences. And I have sadly women who cannot tolerate these levels. We can't get them up to that level. They are aware that they may have already osteoporosis, but they just cannot tolerate higher levels of estrogen. So we need to support them. Additionally, they need to have bone scans. Ideally, they have access to heart scans or cardiologists to support the heart health. So this is very, very, it's a serious health condition. And someone asked, how long should a woman with POI or early menopause continue with HRT? Well, the official recommendation is that she should be continuing until she has reached the age of natural menopause, which in the UK is 51. But saying that, don't do it, don't come off it. If you have found HRT that suits you really well, you function, you have a job, you have energy, do not stop at 51, right? Carry on. Because remember, most women who have symptoms at age 51 who go through a natural menopause will only just start taking HRT then. So why would you stop then? You know, because it is natural to not have estrogen at that age, but it is also not natural to feel rubbish. So if you wean yourself off HRT, if there's no good clinical reason for you to come off your HRT at age 50 or 51, stay on it. It's your decision to stay on it.
And also Ruth. Yeah, no, it's so great. Like some of our friends in the show who have been who are in POI have been on HRT for 20 years, and what Mandy's saying is stay on. If you feel good, stay on. We all, you know, what I'm hearing about is that we all have the right to feel good, and we should. And I wanna make sure we get to Elaine's question. If you have endometriosis and POI, what is the impact of taking HRT on the endo?
And I can answer that because she's the expert.
I'm not an expert, but I guess because I have personal experience, and one of the reasons for my hysterectomy was endometriosis. But I mean, just from what I see in patients as well, endo is a tricky one because obviously it's an estrogen responsive disease, and estrogen can fuel endometriosis, and so we've got to be careful. But I think most women with POI and endometriosis should be able to take replacement, you know, HRT safely, but it's finding the right type of HRT. So endometriosis doesn't really deal well, or doesn't respond well to kind of lots of fluctuations in hormones. I always find that kind of having kind of starting with quite a low dose and having something steady. So for example, having the Marina coil, if somebody's not hoping to conceive, and having, say, a patch, would give the most steady state of hormones in the body. So it's kind of trying to keep your hormonal background status as stable as possible, because that's more likely the endometriosis is going to be more under control. But endo is such a complex condition. It could be that somebody has mild endo in terms of the extent of their disease, and that may not be problematic. But if you've got endometriosis that is in other parts of the body, and is a particular form of endometriosis that can be quite aggressive, you definitely need to see a specialist about that. Or if you've got bowel symptoms, I think I must have been lucky when I had my surgery because I think they must have removed, touch wood, most of the endometriosis, because my pain hasn't been bad. But I do see women who struggle with pain, whether or not they've had surgery, when they start HRT. But normally we can manage these things. It's getting the balance with the estrogen and progesterone right. And normally we would say, if you've had a hysterectomy, had your womb removed, you don't need progesterone. That's not the case if you've had extensive endometriosis, and you may well need progesterone or progesterone, because that can kind of help reduce the negative effects of the estrogen on the endometriosis. So the key thing is, if you've got endo and you're in POI, is you do need to be under a specialist, in that a gynecologist who understands that, really. But I don't know, does that, but it's definitely doesn't rule it out. There are people who say you mustn't take it. That's not the case. There's plenty of women I've seen who have a history of endometriosis, who've had POI, early menopause, surgical menopause, who safely take it, and that, and it's not causing a problem.
Does that answer your question? Yeah, that's great. Good luck. Okay, last question, 5 minutes. Well, let's bring us home. This is a really important one. What interventions or support systems are in place to support the psychological and emotional well-being of women with POI? And how can we create community around it? I mean, we're doing it here, right? But I can imagine it's a really long, hard row to hoe. How can we create?
Well, there's no formal. So unfortunately, our experience is often that women are diagnosed, they're started on treatment, their treatment gets adjusted, and they know what they're doing, and they're discharged, or they're left with the diagnosis to get on. Now it's down to them to find a support group, a charity, or a network that can help them. But there is no formal referral pathway anywhere in the world, as far as I'm aware, to say, look, you've got POI, we've got a great research study here, please join this group. These are international women, you can join this. It doesn't exist. You have to do your own legwork, sadly. There is a charity in the UK called DaisyNet, but again, they're often not always inclusive of everyone. For example, people with women with children, so it is extremely difficult. It's also down to your financial resources, if you can afford a counselor or a psychologist to talk through the issues that come as a result of getting the diagnosis, because it is a lifelong diagnosis. Even, you know, it has so much impact on your relationship, on your sex drive, on your fertility. It is super debilitating. Not everyone can afford a private psychologist or psychotherapist. So sadly, this is severely lacking. There is a super, we want to mention Emily. Will you mention Emily, Hannah?
Yeah. I don't remember the name of her group, but I will.
Mothering and the menopause. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think what Mandy's saying is sadly true. I mean, there are a few places where there may be a psychologist attached to a hospital. I don't know what it's like in the States. For example, at Chelsea and Westminster in England, in London, which is probably the biggest centre that looks after women with POI. That they did used to have a psychologist, but I think a lot of the stuff fell apart again during COVID and everyone was redeployed, and I don't think the team has fully come back together. And that was just one specialist centre in the UK. I mean, in the UK, people can still go to their family doctor, their GP, and ask for a referral to a therapist, but there's long waits, and it wouldn't be somebody necessarily who's got a good understanding of POI, but you may be able to access therapy or support that way. But I think a lot of women are actually kind of providing the support for themselves. There's a lot of peer support. As Mandy said, there is the Daisy Network, which is a charity set up to support people with POI. But there are other groups. So there's a woman on Instagram who's got is mothering in the menopause, and she has got diagnosis of POI but also has young children, and there are obviously particular challenges that come along with that. But of course, we haven't even had the chance really to talk about fertility or what people can do, and that can be one of the most devastating parts. And there are lots of different groups of people who come into the POI category, but they will have different needs and different concerns. And so for a woman who may have had children before she got her diagnosis, it's probably quite difficult for them to be in the same support group as someone who's grieving the fact they never had children and will never have that chance to have children. But everyone deserves support, and everybody's pain is real, and nobody's kind of got a monopoly on that grief and things like that. So people like Emily with the mothering menopause, she's got this support group. There are There's another group here in the UK, Together in Surgical Menopause, for young women who have had their ovaries removed, whether it's via cancer, following PMDD, you know, severe premenstrual disorder, or endometriosis. There are young cancer support groups for women who struggle. So there are, but unfortunately, there's no big organisation that's probably there's no big pathway. We just need to keep raising awareness, and I think one of the good things about social media is that at least people can find their own tribe in some way. And I just think it's important to know that nobody's alone. I mean, there's another, just very quickly, I know we're running out of time, you know, a group, and we wrote about it in the book. There's, you know, other groups have particular challenges. So, say women of colour are more likely to be dismissed and take longer to be diagnosed, or to assume that gynecological changes are more normal or acceptable in that group. And there's lots of, and can be cultural implications and stuff in certain groups. And we've spoke to Dr. Nigat Arif, who's quite a well-known doctor here. She's a GP. And does lots of work in the British Muslim Pakistani community, and talks about the cultural taboo of menopause generally, but POI in particular. Lots of people had come across particular challenges that not everyone would be able to relate to. And I did interview a trans man for the book who had gone through gender-affirming treatment and ended up going through an early menopause, a medical and surgical. But for them, that was something that was positive, because they were then living their life in the gender they felt that was, you know, that they should be living in. But equally, I, for example, have had a couple of non-binary patients who don't feel included in any space, yet they still have POI, they still have the symptoms, they're still concerned about fertility. I think we just know there are a lot of people out there who do need support, but nobody is alone. There will always be somebody who's had that similar experience. And our book is, we try to kind of have resources in there, and so people can maybe find those people that they would be able to connect with. And the book's available to buy, of course, but it is available in libraries, and so people don't have to purchase it, because we just want as many people to get the knowledge that they can. And we have got a long list of support groups and recommendations, because there's no one size fits all, really. Yeah, so that was a long ramble there, but
in the book, you know, it's the Complete Guide to POI and Early Menopause, and it's co-authored by Dr. Hannah Short and Dr. Mandy.
Okay, it's a nice orange book. It looks backwards. Orange,
very positive color. Yeah, what we want everyone to know is, as a community, is how we can create a sense of identity and belonging, and how we can share purpose and participate together. And so Hysterical is a community that you can always come to, and we're always here if you want to learn more about any specific topic, you know, send us an email. We'll certainly put in the show notes some of these different resources. But the long and short of it, see what I did there, Dr. Hannah Short? The long and short of it is that we are not alone if we're brave enough to talk to each other. And we feel so grateful for you putting this work into the world and creating this space for us to learn together and to know that. So thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing so generously. It's been quite amazing.
Well, thank you. And for raising awareness about this topic, because often it's left out, sadly. But thank
you. And often the women are treated as though exactly the same way as a woman in natural menopause, and we need to look at this very differently, because Mandy said it's very different. It's not the same whether somebody has got a POI because of an autoimmune disease, or you know, they might have Turner syndrome, Fragile X, whether they've had their ovaries removed, whether they had radiotherapy or chemotherapy that's damaged their ovaries. It's a completely different kettle of fish to somebody who goes through a natural menopause at 48. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be treating these people the same. So
yes, we're all unique. We're not special in our suffering, but we are all unique, and that's a good reminder. Thank you again. We'll see you all soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.